This is Apologetics Profile, a podcast ministry of Watchman Fellowship, equipping the church, exhorting the non-believer, and exalting Christ.
The old professor in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe is confronted by Lucy's incredulous siblings regarding her claim that she found a whole other world through the back of an old wardrobe in one of the professor's empty bedrooms. Lucy's siblings thought she was lying, or that she might even be experiencing some sort of madness. But the professor confronted them with the fact that Lucy was quite consistent in telling the truth and that she wasn't experiencing a bout of madness. "Why don't they teach logic at these schools?" the professor asked aloud. He tells Peter, Susan, and Edmund, quote, "There are only three possibilities. Either your sister is telling lies, or she is mad, or she is telling the truth. You know she doesn't lie, and it is obvious she is not mad. For the moment, then, and unless any further evidence turns up, we must assume that she is telling the truth," end quote. After giving Lucy's siblings a quick lesson in logic and a hint that his house is stranger than even he imagines it to be, he mutters to himself, quote, "I wonder what they do teach them at these schools," end quote. Spirit, I thought to look up what the contemporary mission statement of Harvard University was. The website says, quote, "The mission of Harvard College is to educate the citizens and citizen leaders of our society. We do this through our commitment to the transformative power of a liberal arts and sciences education. Beginning in the classroom with exposure to new ideas, new ways of understanding, and new ways of knowing, students embark on a journey of intellectual transformation. Through a diverse learning environment where students live with people who are studying different topics, who come from different walks of life, and have evolving identities, intellectual transformation is deepened and conditions for social transformation are created. From this, we hope that students will begin to fashion their lives by gaining a sense of what they want to do with their gifts and talents, assessing their values and interests, and learning how they can best serve the world," end quote. C.S. Lewis might have a few questions for the board of Harvard. What is meant by intellectual transformation? What is an evolving identity? What sort of social transformation does Harvard hope to promote? And it seems the whole point of a Harvard education today is to be teaching students how to fashion their own lives by doing what they wish to do. This is a radical cry from Harvard's founding in 1636 by Puritans who had come to Massachusetts Bay early in the 17th century. Consider Harvard's original mission statement, quote, "Everyone shall consider as the main end of his life and studies to know God and Jesus Christ, which is eternal life," John 17:3, end quote. In Christe Gloriam, for the glory of Christ, served as the school's motto. A decade after the founding of Harvard, English and Scottish theologians came together to create the Westminster Catechism, a series of theological questions and answers pertaining to the basic Christian doctrines. The first question of the Catechism asks, what is the chief end or purpose of man? The answer? To glorify God and enjoy Him forever. As the Apostle Paul exhorts the Corinthians, quote, "So whether you eat or drink, or whatever you do, do it all for the glory of God," end quote. So what exactly happened between 1636 and today that Harvard's mission statement has so radically changed? The late Christian philosopher and apologist Francis Schaeffer observed that shortly after the Protestant Reformation of the 16th century, A man-centered humanism began to seep into Protestant theology and practice. Schaeffer notes, quote, "A more total form of humanism entered the Protestant Church and has gradually spread to all the branches of the Church, including the Roman Catholic. The concept of man, beginning from himself, now began to be expressed in theology and theological language. Or we can say that these theologians accepted the presuppositions of rationalism," end quote. Religion in general, Schaeffer argues, quote, "gradually was relegated to the realm of non-reason, and since reason has no place there, there is no room for discussion. There are only arbitrary pronouncements," end quote. In simple terms, the self gradually came to replace God as the center and measure of all things. The catechism of the postmodern self today might be, "What is the chief end of man? To serve the self and enjoy it as long as you can." In July of 1958, President Dwight D. Eisenhower signed into existence the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. The opening of the Declaration of Policy and Purpose in the 1958 document states that, quote, "The Congress hereby declares that it is the policy of the United States that activities in space should be devoted to peaceful purposes for the benefit of all mankind," end quote. Today, NASA's official mission statement found on their webpage reads, quote, "NASA explores the unknown in air and space, innovates for the benefit of humanity, and inspires the world through discovery. We share a set of core values, safety, integrity, teamwork, excellence, inclusion, and they are evident in all that we do," end quote. I did a word search on the original 1958 document signed by President Eisenhower. There was not a single mention of God, nor is there any mention of God on the current NASA website. But how does a science institution determine what benefits humanity? What exactly is NASA hoping to inspire in the world? And what do they mean by inclusion? Neither Harvard nor NASA today are deliberately promoting anti-theism by any means. But by omitting God from their primary mission statements and purposes, it does nevertheless give atheism and unbelief apparent cultural force, as neither of these institutions consider God to be relevant to their own institution and purpose. And by omitting God from their official statements, tacitly, man is now free and unencumbered to make himself into whatever he wants to be. This tacit assumption that God is not important and the rise of the autonomous self serve as the ideological foundations of a cultural chaotic social media movement known today as deconstruction, loosely affiliated with a postmodern philosophy by the same name created by the late French philosopher Jacques Derrida. When asked in 1994 what he thought deconstruction was, Derrida replied, quote, "That is impossible," end quote, but then quipped, quote, "Sometimes it may be useful to try," end quote. This is the philosophical madness that is Derrida's deconstruction. Adherents of Derrida claim that deconstruction resists definition and reduction to simple principles. But therein is the central contradiction of deconstruction. Its basic core principles are then that it resists simple definitions and ought not to be reduced to simple principles. It must remain restless, chaotic, undefined, and elusive. So on the one hand, Derrida wants to claim deconstruction is elusive and undefinable, while on the other hand, he nevertheless makes concrete statements about what it is not. This same contrary logic can be found in the contemporary social media movement of deconstruction. There is no one right way to define it. There is no end goal. There is no one right way to do it. And if you think you know what it is, you're probably wrong. Yet social media deconstructionists are united on the front that, at the very least, deconstruction means doing as much repudiating of your former Christian faith as you can. Tear it down to the roots and don't worry about what comes next. It is a kind of intellectual, philosophical, and theological anarchy, with no foresight into what may result afterward. The only aim of deconstruction is tearing down the Christian faith. I think were Lewis alive today, he would probably be scratching his head in wonder, what do they teach them at these schools? As apologist with Stand to Reason Tim Barnett shared with us a few weeks ago, it seems schools are teaching us to do whatever we think is right in our own eyes. But as was the case in the book of Judges, so it is with us today. We need a savior from ourselves. It is not finally Christians versus atheists or deconstructionists versus the church or Jacques Derrida versus the French Catholics. But all of us are in need of the grace and mercy of the Lord Jesus Christ in delivering us from our sin. In waging spiritual warfare, we must remember we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but principalities and powers in heavenly places whose tactics are finally nothing new. As we begin part two of our conversation with philosopher Dr. Timothy McGrew and his daughter Beth L. regarding the intellectual and cultural roots of unbelief in the West, I asked Beth L. to comment about this institutional unbelief, where organizations like Harvard and NASA are not finally deliberately promoting atheism or unbelief, but by omitting God from their mission statements, they do continue to foster a culture of unbelief nonetheless. Here is Beth L. McGrew.
That's absolutely true. And I've seen various think pieces and articles about this that are kind of talking about this problem that Christians have trouble sort of getting a foot in the door at institutions of higher learning. Or if they are there, they're sort of expected to keep their faith kind of under their hat. And it's not supposed to really intersect with what they do professionally. Mm. So, you know, that there's a sort of, Stephen Jay Gould's non-overlapping magisteria comes in here where, you know, Gould will say, well, I'm not hostile to religion. I think religion has a very important place in our culture, in our society, but it's just in its own separate category,
yeah.
Right? You know, religion over here, history, science, academia.
Back to what you said there. About Francis Schaeffer, upper story, lower story.
Yeah, sure. Right. It's its own version of that. So, like, unfortunately, I think even some Christians have embraced that. I mean, like, we were talking about Thomas Aquinas, a guy that Aquinas wrote against was named Averroes. So there's an Averroistic idea that you have your faith hat and your professional hat.
Mm.
These are different hats.
Mm.
So that's something I think Christians need to actively push back against, and get over, you know, especially Christians who want to go into academia, they should be boldly integrated. Like,
yeah.
Yes, I'm a Christian, but also, yes, I'm a fill-in-the-blank, a scientist, a historian, and I do these things together. I don't do them separately.
Uh-huh.
Now, but then to your point, that may mean they have trouble finding a job in higher learning, so they'll probably wind up teaching classical Christian high school somewhere, you know? But then that there is a sort of alternative educational network emerging there, as a function of the fact that institutes of higher learning are, you know, not leaving space or leaving a place for that.
Right, yeah. Right. Along those lines, this Christmas, NASA and the Space Telescope Science Institute put out a stunning image of a galactic field taken by the James Webb and the Hubble Space Telescope, a combined image, and they called it the Christmas Tree Galaxy Cluster. Big press release. It was in the New York Times. And underneath, so I looked at it and clicked on it, and you can go to the Hubble Space Telescope Science Institute website. They have press contacts. You can contact people if you want to talk about, if you want somebody to talk about the image. We'll be glad to. So I contacted the press. I said, I'm a Christian podcast. We'd love to have an astrophysicist explain the Christmas Nebula. And maybe it would be helpful if your astrophysicist could be informally conversant about a little bit of Christian theology. You name this Christmas tree. I wasn't saying they have to be a Christian. I was just saying we have a large Christian audience. Would you be happy to explain galaxies to Christians? I'm sorry we don't have anybody on staff that would be a fit for your request. And this was, this is the gist of what I'm talking about. It's like going to the Louvre, seeing a few Van Goghs and asking, well, asking a docent about, well, who painted these things? Well, I have absolutely nobody on staff that could tell you that. Why are these hanging in your walls? You know? But I think this gets back, and maybe Tim, you can comment here. This idea, this idea of a tacit atheism, where people aren't militant against God, it's just God's never spoken of. There seems to be an intentionality with the French philosophers when you have Diderot and D'Alembert create the encyclopedia where they're, I don't think Jesus is ever mentioned in that work. I haven't read it extensively at all, but it seems like the whole idea of that project was, let's create a body of knowledge that makes Christianity and religion and God peripheral. Would you say that this is where this impulse comes from, where we get our institutions, where it's not intentionally godless like they were maybe, but by God's absence?
So the impulse, yes. I'm not sure that there's a direct line, because a lot of the institutions that we look at now were actually founded as schools for the training of ministers,
yeah,
Harvard,
okay,
and Yale.
Yeah.
And yet, as you know, recent events have shown, Harvard and Yale are a long way from training the sorts of ministers that they were training back when they were founded. So, but the impulse, I think, that we see operating is the same impulse. If you view religion in general, perhaps Christianity in particular, with contempt or disdain, or even if you think that it's well worth ignoring because it's not really a knowledge-producing enterprise, it doesn't add anything to the sum total of
epistemologically
human
knowledge, marginal, in
right,
general.
Then, of course, you're going to devote your time, your resources to real knowledge. Why wouldn't you, right? Mm-hmm. You might have a few folklorists whose job it is to catalog the knowledge of the sort of odd things that odd people have said from time to time. But that's it. That's as far as it's going to go, right? And so we relegate religion to comparative religion. We would like to see the common strands in the nonsense that people have spun out, and we'd like to see the varieties of ways that social pressures make their nonsense somewhat different, and we can view that all from our benign position of realizing that, of course, there's not a shred of truth in any of this.
When
we do that, then we are capitulating to a certain view about what can and what cannot produce knowledge. And I think that that view is what we're still facing. We're going to be facing this eternally because the impulse surfaces again and again. Paul on Mars Hill.
Right.
He's getting a hearing until he mentions the resurrection from the dead.
And then,
and it's like, wait, well, okay, that's a bridge too far. Come
right.
on. Just to look at these kinds of things and try to take these seriously, to try to take anything that is beyond the scope of what we've approved and stamped our approval on, this naturalistic stuff, that's just a bridge too far. We're not going to take the folklore seriously as a description of reality, merely as a description of the curious stories that people tell. That's as far as we're going to go with that.
So how we go from going back to the I think it was 17th century, you mentioned Robert Boyle.
Sure, right.
Father of modern chemistry,
right,
perhaps of what we consider to be the scientific method, a Christian, a philanthropist, a natural philosopher in the sense of understanding theology.
Sure, sure.
How do we go from a Robert Boyle establishing these things on the precepts of the world is intelligent based on the fact that God has created everything? Mm-hmm. How do we go from a Boyle to a kind of secularism in the sciences today? Where was this step? In the modern sense, where do we start to slip? The Enlightenment that comes after Boyle, where are we shifting gears?
To some extent, I think it's Darwin, but Darwin is himself fallen into despair about Christianity because of the work of the biblical scholars who are coming in the wake of David Friedrich Strauss, who, writing in the 1830s and himself building on previous works of skeptics and deists, sort of tried to discredit the biblical narrative. So Hans Frey has a book called The Eclipse of Biblical Narrative. This idea that there was an account of how it all fit together, and then it just gradually crumbled under careful investigation. And the terrible thing about Strauss is that he persuaded people not because he had good arguments, but because he very persuasively packaged something that at the bottom was based on bad philosophy. David Hume.
Yeah.
Yet again. And you can see this both in his life of Jesus and in his new life of Jesus for the
German
people.
Did he have a strain of Voltaire in his thinking too, did he not?
So, yes. I mean, he was very antagonistic toward religion, but he's a little bit more urbane than Voltaire. Voltaire will speak openly of...
Yeah, he was a little saucy.
Yeah, hanging the last king in the entrails of the last priest.
Yeah.
And Strauss didn't go there, but he did just think that miracles were incredible, just not believable. And he had picked up that from Hume's writings, had a cruder version of it even than Hume himself had had.
Mm-hmm.
And then that spilled through biblical studies and over into the more literary field. So Matthew Arnold, in the second edition, the cheaper edition of his book Literature and Dogma, has an introduction where he says the primary reason that we can't believe the New Testament is that the New Testament is just brimful of miracles and prodigies.
And Matthew Arnold was the Dover Beach.
Yes, he's the Dover Beach poet, right. Mm-hmm. And he says, miracles do not happen.
And then he says the tide of religious faith is going out.
It's going out, and the implication is, and it's never coming back.
Right.
Right? So they've got this view that, yeah, you know, we used to believe that, and it kind of made sense for a while, and it gave meaning and structure to life, and now we don't have it. And some of them are glad about that. Some of them are unhappy about that.
Yeah.
But there it is. What are we going to do? We are all modern men, right?
Yeah.
We're not.
So it seems like you have these pivotal writers just sort of planting a flag and making a claim, and everybody goes, oh, yeah. But they're really not making... I mean, we talked last year about Hume and his juvenilia in terms of it's a very immature kind of way that it just seems to be... People are just like taking something that somebody said and running with it and not doing the legwork, like what you were saying about Dawkins. They would just pick up what Dawkins said, but to that credit of that philosopher, he challenges Dawkins to think a little bit more deeply about this. So it seems like atheism is just kind of one stepping stone from one person to a next, just repeating things.
And so here's the challenge. So is much in Christianity. We're always looking for the people who can... I cannot tell you how many times I had this experience on the internet. I'd be in a Facebook group, and someone would come rushing into the group, and he'd been having an argument with some skeptic, and he'd say, what do we say about loop quantum gravity?
Oh, like you've got all the answers for everything, and I'm just going to repeat what you say.
Right, and I just said, why are you having an argument about loop quantum gravity? If you don't know what it is, then why don't you just say, hey, that's outside of my expertise. Would you like to talk to somebody who's got more knowledge about that? Pass it off. But there's a great temptation to vanity to appear something.
We all do it.
And then that is also something that's facilitated by our doing a lot of borrowing.
Yeah.
And to some extent, we're going to do a certain amount of borrowing because we can't have direct knowledge of all the things we'd like to be able to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
But that impulse can take over. And when it does, you get the spectacle of people who really couldn't make a tenable defense of what they're saying against even superficial objections, but their level of confidence is outscaled because they've heard somebody else say it and it sounded smart and they're repeating it.
One quick question shows the shallowness of our thinking. But I want to kind of skirt into, since this is going to talk about postmodernism a little bit.
Sure.
What I really wanted to do was get to the point of talking about how deconstruction Derrida and deconstruction evangelicalism is or is not related, and how it kind of comes out of an atheism, maybe even Derrida, because his deconstruction was more political and language is oppressive, I think, to some extent from what I understand of him. And then deconstruction in the evangelical sense is just people making their own narrative about what is true and what is not.
I lived through a period of time as I was a graduate student at Vanderbilt where the Vanderbilt philosophy department was split down the middle between the deconstructionists and everybody else.
Okay.
And so I heard a lot of what you might term left-wing deconstruction.
Now, when you're talking about that, you're talking about the philosophical deconstruction.
I am talking the philosophical stuff. So Derrida, Foucault, Deleuze, Lyotard, these were the names to conjure with at the time. So just sort of a very brief orientation, not even a full summary, but an orientation toward what Derrida is doing with that. Derrida's approach runs rather like this. There are, in the worldviews of most people in the West, certain hierarchies. Certain things are good, other things are bad. Certain things are more important, other things are less important. And those hierarchies turn out to be remarkably similar across communities, a variety of people, right? Truth is good, falsehood is bad. Morality is good, immoral actions are bad. We value, we give a privilege to certain things over other things. Deconstruction, as Derrida explains it, involves two movements. The first movement is to take those hierarchies and to invert them.
Mm.
The normal and the perverse, turn it inside out. Give priority to the perverse over the normal. The rational and the irrational, turn it inside out. Give the irrational dominance over the rational. So we invert the hierarchies. We attempt to show that even within the works of the people who think that they're working reasonably and rationally, they are themselves in subtle ways that perhaps only we can see, subverting their own claims to rationality, and we can show that these hierarchies actually are getting inverted even within their own works. And then the second move is just demolish the entire idea that there's anything with a hierarchy over anything else and just eliminate all the hierarchies.
It's kind of anarchistic in a sense.
Anarchy is absolutely where it ends. Mm. So you start saying, well, there are these hierarchies to which people appeal. Then you invert them and you try to show that they're subverting themselves. Then you say, and you know what? None of this has...
Throw it all out.
Right, throw it all out. Where you end up with that is, oddly enough, in a place that is similar to the one described by someone who is not a postmodernist in the classic sense, not influenced by that strand of things, an analytic philosopher whose name is Alex Rosenberg.
Yeah.
So he has a book called The Atheist's Guide to Reality.
Right.
And the first few pages of that are just a walking dictionary of nihilism.
It is.
What is the meaning of life? There is no meaning of life.
Mm.
Well, how does language have meaning? It doesn't. I notice he's copyrighted his book, but he says language has no meaning. Right? So there are all of these extremely sad attempts to undermine the prioritization that we have given culturally, and there's all these attempts to undermine the priority that all of us, Christians and non-Christians, have given to certain ideas, all in the name of a consistently worked out atheism. That was what Jean-Paul Sartre was trying to do. He, you know, what is existentialism? Well, it's an attempt to work out consistently the consequences of atheism.
Right.
It's what Camus was attempting to show us. Mm-hmm. So these existentialists, some of the deconstructionists, and oddly enough, some of the more nihilistic analytic philosophers all have come to the point of trying to say, we are going to throw out the old hierarchies of meaning, the old hierarchies of reason.
Mm.
And paradoxically, when the analytic philosophers try to do it, it's in the name of reason. But we know now that there is no such thing as meaning.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, how do we know that? It just...
That seems to be the, you know, again, like people have pointed out, that the double standard of that kind of deconstruction is that obviously Derrida is trying to make meaning of something. You have to have something that is true to make a statement about anything else. But
I once read a piece by Derrida that was actually admirably lucid and to the point. It was an argument for why the humanities deserved more government funding. And he suddenly, all of the funny vocabulary and weird ungrammatical constructions were gone, and it was just like very straightforward argument for the value of the humanities. I thought it was hilarious. What it said to me is that a fair amount of what Derrida was doing in his more celebrated work was a put-up job, and he knew it.
Yeah, he goes and plays backgammon when he's done.
Right, yes, like Hume did.
Yeah, exactly. How much politics is involved in this? And it's more than just a worldview, but people seem to think that there are political issues that are driving people away from faith. And so when people leave the Christian faith, there's so many inroads from modernity that are influencing people's construction of their own narratives. What do you think?
Yeah. Well, I mean, when Jordan Peterson talks about postmodern neo-Marxism, people will say, well, that's nonsense. These are, you know, Marxism is a modernist phenomenon.
Yeah.
And you're mashing it up with postmodernism. And he'll go, well, yeah, I know, but it happens, you know, you can see it. And he's not wrong. I mean, there are people who they're modernist when it suits them and they're postmodernist when it suits them. I mean, like Dad was just saying, Derrida himself, when he had something he was actually passionate about, suddenly...
He's clear and bright and lucid.
Right, he's not a postmodernist anymore because, yeah. It is fundamentally nonsensical. It is unsustainable.
Mm-hmm.
And so today, personally, I prefer to just say deconversion, because that just sort of cleanly keeps it separate from the technical philosophical deconstructionist school.
Right, right.
But as you say, that there are lots of political factors, and people who they're not saying there's no such thing as truth. They're kind of saying the opposite. They're saying that there is truth. It's the opposite of whatever the Christians are saying. It's my truth. They're actually moral Puritans in their own way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So there's so the deconstruction of what we'll call deconversion is actually more grounded in this idea that there is some kind of truth.
Yeah.
Rather than a radical subjectivism of the existentialists of like Camus, where killing somebody or taking a nap doesn't make any difference.
Right.
To somebody leaving the Christian faith. No, that does make a difference. I want to be moral. I still think there's something real about the world.
Yeah.
I'm just constructing my own truth, as you say it. Do you think that's a fair assessment?
Yeah. And Neil Shenvey has done lots of great work.
Yeah.
Sort of tracing social justice and the kind of academic origins of that and how that's filtered into the popular consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people have an idea that Christianity is fundamentally unjust.
Yeah.
In X, Y, and Z.
Right.
Different ways. And they'll, I have a friend who talks about the church back home syndrome. I grew up in a thus and such something something fundamentalist, blah, 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 where, everyone hated gay people.
Yeah.
Women were suppressed or
right.
Whatever, fill in the blank.
Mm-hmm.
And now, wow, I'm so much more enlightened and I can look back from my exalted vantage point.
Right.
And I'm just a much more moral and just
person. Yeah, and it's interesting. There's a historical parallel with that, Bethel. I think that when you look at the language of the new atheists and what you said earlier about looking at the two different kinds of trajectories of history, the atheist narrative from Democritus forward is we've outgrown the gods.
Yeah.
And in a personal sense, in a personal deconversion, I've outgrown the religion of my childhood. And so there's this, what C.S. Lewis might call the chronological snobbery. Like, now is more enlightened than 20 years ago. While there may be some truth in personal development about what we learn, yes. But in a general sense, the trajectory of history from an atheistic standpoint seems to be one of chronological snobbery. That this is the most enlightened age simply because we're in the 21st century.
Well, that's right. There was this little term. Sometimes atheists would call themselves the Brights.
Yes, Dan Dennett and company.
And even Christopher Hitchens sort of had enough self-awareness to realize, that sounds kind of... I don't really like that.
Right, right.
That was how they thought of themselves. And so that's exactly what it is. We just know so much better now. Or Sam Harris, when he'll talk about the Bible, it's, Bronze Age peasants, something, something.
Right, right, right. Well, the whole idea of the Bronze Age goat herding mythicists, I had a friend of mine at a book club one time. He was an atheist. He brought this up. He says, why do you believe in Bronze Age goat herding texts? And I said, well, can you wander through the Sinai wilderness with paper that you made, with a pen and ink that you made, writing a story as you're keeping track of your goats and sheep about the universe and about God, and expect it 20 centuries later to be a bestseller? You go ahead and wander through Sinai with your own handmade materials and write a bestseller. It's like, well, so you're kind of insulting yourself if you want to denigrate the Bronze Age goat herders, because they've produced the most widely read book in all of human history.
Right. I know. People will say, what would convince you that this really came from God. Well, maybe if we were reading the Old Testament, we found E equals MC squared in there. That would have been good. That would have really been proof of something.
Right, an anachronistic assumption about
it. Or if we found, like some sort of mathematical equation or a code or a message.
Yeah.
I'm like, so DNA isn't code? I mean, that's back to science.
Right.
People don't want to talk about that.
Right. It sounds a lot like Psalm 139 to me. You've fearfully and wonderfully made, knit me together in my mother's womb.
Yeah. I was thinking of a poem.
Okay.
While we were talking.
Absolutely.
This is one of my favorite poems by an Irish writer named Denis O'Driscoll.
Okay.
And I don't know if he was, Christian or maybe kind of a lapsed Catholic or agnostic or whatever, but he has this amazing poem called Missing God.
Okay.
I'll just read the first stanza, and I encourage people to look this up.
Yeah.
But, he's just sort of talking about everything that we've been talking about, the subtraction story of history where now we feel like we've outgrown God, but
there's something
missing.
There's something missing.
Right. Exactly. So here's the first stanza. His grace is no longer called for before meals. Farmed fish multiply without his intercession. Bread production rises through disease-resistant grains devised scientifically to mitigate his faults. Yet, though we rebelled against him like adolescents, uplifted to see an oppressive father banished, a bearded hermit to the desert, we confess to missing him at times. Miss him during the civil wedding, when at the blossomy altar of the registrar's desk, we wait in vain to be fed a line containing words like everlasting and divine. We miss him when the TV scientist explains the cosmos through equations, leaving our planet to revolve on its axis aimlessly, a wheel skidding in snow. Miss him when the radio catches a snatch of plain chant from some echoey priory, when the gospel choir raises its voice, its collective voice, to ask, shall we gather at the river? Or the forces of the oratorio converge on, I know that my Redeemer liveth, and our contracted hearts lose a beat.
Wow.
So I won't keep going, but it's an amazing poem.
That is wonderful.
Yeah, it is wonderful. And it just sort of ends, it doesn't like...
it's a much nicer version of Nietzsche's Madman. Like, instead of saying
the gentler version.
We miss God instead of we killed God, but the gist is the same. What are you going to do now? How are you going to articulate our experience now?
That's right.
Nietzsche says we've been unloosed from the solar system. Now we're just spinning balls of mathematical equations.
Wheels getting the snow.
When we get married, it's just a matter of pragmatics or convenience or whatever, but the invocation is gone.
Yeah.
We don't have the right language without God. I think even it was Dawkins, even in the God Delusion, that says, look, I'll give a hand clap to the Bible for the very linguistic contributions that's given to the English.
Oh, sure, Englishman. He was
the
King James.
Right,
you know?
I mean, but he's the point is, take away, even if you don't believe the Bible, take away the language of the Bible, take away the stories of the Bible, and our culture collapses. It's going to struggle. If you take that away, Nietzsche is right. You need an Ubermensch. You need something. You know, nature and bachelors abhor vacuuming. If you take away the Bible, there will be a kind of vacuum, culturally speaking, that we'll be struggling to make sense of. That's a great poem, a good way to go. Final thoughts, Bethel, on what we've been talking about. What do you think? What can we do as Christians going forward? What would you recommend?
So I think I would go back to what I was saying earlier about being integrated. I think it's very important to reject the two-story model, reject the non-overlapping magisteria model. It takes a little bit of intestinal fortitude to do that because you do encounter resistance from people who are like, hey, you know, stop stepping on my turf. You're supposed to stay over there. You're not supposed to.
Right.
I love Tom Holland. He's a Christian-friendly historian who's been doing interesting stuff recently. But, even Tom kind of has that mentality a little bit where, he'll go this far, but no farther. So I think, the Christian's job is to keep sort of gently coming back and saying, well, no, actually, we do have something to say about reality. Religion is actually a... It contributes knowledge. You know, it contributes to the store of knowledge.
The early Christians were thoughtful. We're thinking of Robert Boyle and maybe even before then, and going back to Aquinas and Augustine.
Yeah.
That Christians in those times were good generalists. Mm-hmm. That they had a wide vocabulary about a great many things.
Oh, fabulous! And I mean, like Augustine's whole. I mean, we were talking about Plato. Augustine's whole project was like, hey guys, you know, Plato was talking about the good, right? Well, boy, have I got news for you.
Yeah.
The good is actually God.
Right.
You know?
Plato, Augustine is Acts 17 on steroids, I guess.
For sure.
Yeah.
So I think we need to take a leaf from Augustine.
Yeah, so I think the encouragement is to be, as Christians, you don't have to be a scholar. You don't have to be a formal apologist. But as Christians, I think the vocabulary, the impetus, the call is to be good generalists and have a good working knowledge that enables you to be conversant throughout the culture and where we strive. And that's what we're doing the podcast for. And that's why we love having the McGrews on the podcast, because you guys are good generalists. You can speak about a wide variety of things. I've talked to your dad, talked to your mom, and now I've talked to you. And this has been a fantastic way to do that. So thank you, Bethel, so much for your time.
Thanks so much for having me. It's been great.
Sanctify Christ as Lord in your hearts, always being ready to make a defense to everyone who asks you to give an account for the hope that is in you, yet with gentleness and reverence.